Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic. It is my pleasure to welcome Fred Schenkelberg back to the podcast. Welcome back, Fred.
Hey, James. Glad to be back.
So, Fred, for those that may not be familiar with you, you have been a frequent, I think I'll use the term, guest to the Rooted in Reliability podcast. But I don't think we've had recorded one in the last little bit. So what have you been up to lately?
Well, the most urgent thing right now, I have a deadline coming up in a couple of days as we're recording this, is preparing a advanced learning session for the SMRP conference that's coming up this fall. And it's about an hour and a half, hour, 45-minute slot that I get, which I understand you were telling me, James, before we started, that that's a new thing for the conference. So pretty excited to be leading off with one of these new formats for them. And it gives me plenty of time to dive deep into the topic that I love talking about, which is how we talk about reliability, how we inform the decisions that we need to make all across whatever we're doing concerning reliability engineering. And of course, I'm talking about MTBF and that how bad that is and what you should do instead so you can make better informed decision. So, of course, I waited to the last, to the deadline. I've been thinking about it for weeks and got, I don't know, five or six different outlines. Now I'm trying to put it all together into a coherent presentation and discussion, but it should be fun.
It would definitely be a great topic to have at SMRP. MTBF and why it's bad for business. I think that's a great topic, and I think it's going to spur a lot of discussion, and I'm looking forward to personally sitting in on that and listening to the banter, I think, is the best way to put it.
All right. Well, I don't know. Well, you've never attended one of my presentations. I don't know if you've been on any of my webinars. I did one this morning and with lots of discussion. It's when I do it live, it's a lot more interactive. I don't talk for the whole length and then 5 minutes, all right, what are your questions? It's a discussion all the way through. And so I try to make it much more interactive and relevant for the questions people have in the audience. And so that should be fun. The other part, James, is, you know, you and I have been recording podcasts together and talking about a variety of different things professionally for what, 2 years, 3 years now, something like that?
At least 2 years.
Yeah. And we've never met. It's the advent of the internet, I guess.
Yes, but we'll have a chance at the SMRP annual conference. So I think that'll be huge. Be able to sit down, have a coffee with you or a beer, depending on what time of the day it is, and actually just, you know, be able to sit down with you in person.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that. And I'm also, I've already been asked through LinkedIn. And so are you going to be at the conference? And I said, you know, yes, this is my first time at SMRP, and I was invited to do this work or this advanced learning session. So I'm pretty excited by the whole adventure. Plus, catching up with folks like you and others that I know that are in the industry. Plus, I suspect between your podcast and mine and the Ascendo Reliability site, there's plenty of people that we may just have to schedule a lunch or a dinner and just sit down and talk shop and meet each other and do that kind of stuff. That might be fun.
Absolutely be a blast.
Yeah. Now, so what have you been up to? You've been traveling. Last I talked to you, you were, I think, going to six states in 3 days or something like that.
Yeah,
some crazy schedule.
I'm currently in California. And like you, I am trying to get my paper and presentation done for SMRP with the 2-day deadline. Like you, I have been thinking about it, but push comes to shove. Now it's time to get it done.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah.
But the reason I wanted to talk to you today is I had a question from someone in a class I was teaching. And while I understand the difference and was able to articulate what the difference is, I wanted to get a second opinion on that question.
Okay.
And that question is, What is a reliability growth analysis, or CROAMSA, and how is that different from a Weibull analysis? But I think in order to answer that, we need to kind of summarize what is a reliability growth analysis and what is a Weibull, and then maybe discuss the differences. I think that may help provide some clarity. Thoughts?
Okay. Yeah, and we've written about this before, didn't we? I think it was one of our first projects together, as we did a series, and it included these two topics. So it may be useful to link back to those older articles. It has more details and some graphics. Of course, the first thing I'm going to do is start waving in the air and drawing graphics, and that's not going to help our audience here.
No, but we will make sure to link back to those posts, and I believe we created an ebook. So if I can find that link, I will set that in there as well.
That'd be great. So CROAMSA is part Larry Crowe, is a consultant nowadays, but he was instrumental in updating and refining a growth reliability growth models. AMSA is Army Material something something. It's one of these 5 or 6 letter acronyms from the U.S. military. But it's a research laboratory, essentially. And so they had some start in this process. But essentially what it is that we're building a complex weapon system, for example, the Army guys, or we have a complex piece of equipment that's repairable. And we're not going to make 100 prototypes. We might only make 100 total ever, kind of thing. They're expensive. They're complicated. There's lots of moving bits and parts and complicated interfaces. And the idea was that if we keep track of all of the issues or failures or problems that we have with that on our very first prototype, and then we work to fix those things, we make sure the torque is set correctly on this bolt, or we reroute wiring so it doesn't fray, or we whatever the process is to improve the design, the next time we run that tank, for example, it should run longer before it has failures, or it should have less failures over a duration of time. And so the underpinning philosophy is that as we get improving as we improve the design and as we improve the manufacturing process and how we build these things, we should have fewer and fewer and fewer problems that we need to address or fix or repair or redesign. And that rollover of a curve, if you think of it as here's where I'm waving my hands, is the vertical axis is essentially the count of the number of failures F, the cumulative count, or usually it does it in a log scale for some reason, and then time. And if that curve is going very vertically, we're receiving lots and lots of failures, new problems per unit time, and there's no end in sight. We're nowhere near ready to launch this product because it's not stable. But if we keep working at it and we're diligent about fixing issues and not introducing new ones with every design change, that curve will eventually roll over. It'll flatten out. It'll take longer and longer for new failures to appear. Now, on a CROAMSA, and I think in the AMSA model, and there's a handful of other models, they construct the axes such that it's a straight line. And the slope of that line gives you an indication of how well you're doing. And so it's a tracking method to, are we there yet? Are we stable yet? Have we found enough of the issues yet? And does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And with that too, I believe the CROAMSA, based on that slope, will tell you if reliability is improving, if it's getting worse, if it's staying steady.
That's right.
But in addition to that, once you have that slope number, you can somewhat accurately predict, depending on the quality of your data, when that next failure is likely to occur. Correct?
Yeah, to some extent. I think there's a lot of, to me personally, there's a lot of hand waving going on there. It's because there's a lot of assumptions about, well, how mature do you think your development team is? And then you give them a number. And then that eventually informs the slope. And I'm like, really? Let's use the real data here. Now, when you're in a development program or a piece of equipment's being commissioned, for example, use the real data. And then you'll can track and follow that curve essentially to give you that predictive power. So it can work there. And in maintenance worlds, we use something similar to that. In the CRO-AMSA model is one of them, where we're using our actual failure data, right? Our actual downtime data, and then use that as a predictive model.
Yes. And that's where I'm more leading to is using your existing failure data that you're capturing on that asset to generate that model and predict that next likely failure.
Yeah. What's really cool about it is you can start it, you know, even if you have a 20-year-old piece of equipment, you can, and your data is, you know, somewhere back, fell behind the cabinet kind of thing. You can start today and just set that as time zero and start tracking and see where you're at. It may, depending on how many failures you have and the rate they appear, it takes some time before you can get a curve, essentially, or fit a line to this. And then you can use it fairly accurately. Of course, the more information, the more data, the more failures, the more similar pieces of equipment that are operating, the more accurate it'll be.
Yeah. And of course, the actual data quality itself, how accurate is the failure times, the time between failures, those sorts of things.
That's right.
That plays a huge role in how accurate and predictive that model can be.
That's right.
Now, with the reliability growth analysis or CRO-AMSA, do we have to stay to a specific failure mode in that model, or is that mixed failure modes, or, you know, as opposed to a WIBEL, where I believe a WIBEL, you have to stick to a specific failure mode. Is that the case with the reliability growth analysis?
Yeah, you can stay with a mixed mode. It's this, you're basically looking at it as a system. What takes my system down? What are the problems that stop the tank from rolling, for example, or it's not mission ready, for example, a piece of equipment's not up. So anything that takes it down is fodder for a growth model. You can get more accurate with that, but at some point when you're down to a single failure mechanism, the WIBEL, or more accurately using the appropriate distribution, and we generically call it a WIBEL analysis, is more powerful from a statistical point of view. It's more accurate. So WIBEL would be for not repairable systems, you know, say a bearing. Right. If I have time to failure of all these bearings on my plant that are similar, doing a WIBEL analysis on that, a time to failure analysis would be appropriate and the right tool for it. If it's a system, say it's a bottling plant or a piece of equipment or a labeler or something like that, and it's got not only bearings, it's got motors and rollers and sensors and all kinds of stuff on it, then the growth model would be more appropriate.
All right. So the growth model, in addition to being mixed failure modes as opposed to a single failure mode as WIBEL, is also better suited for those complex maintainable systems as opposed to a single component, which is not maintainable, non-repairable, in which case a WIBEL is better used.
That's right.
Excellent.
That's right. Yeah. And I tend to, there's a number of issues I have with, and I know others do too, with the CRO-AMSA and AMSA type models, reliability growth models, because of some of the underlying assumptions is, and it's really based on that you're using an exponential distribution. Now, some variants are, get more complicated, but there's still some assumptions going into it, which simplifies the calculations, but also I think affects its accuracy. And so I tend to go to a non-parametric method, and we wrote about that also, called a mean cumulative function. And there are statistical methods to fit lines to those things, but even just the graphic alone is immensely informative to know how your system is doing and how your maintenance program is affecting your assets.
Yes, and we did do a deep dive on mean cumulative function in that post, so we'll make sure to link to that. But with some of these concerns, why is the reliability growth analysis or CRO-AMSA so popular, or why is it used and widely adopted?
It's a military standard. That's the only reason I know of. There are better methods that are, in my mind, a whole lot easier to understand and interpret and use. But there's a military structure and a whole series of consultants and standards that pretty much keep the modeling tools alive. It's the only reason I have for it. And there may be others that I'm not aware of, but that, just because it's everybody does it doesn't mean it's the right method to use.
Just like MTBF. But that's for another day. We're not going to get into that one today.
Well, MTBF is central in those growth models a lot of times. So you got to be careful in the non-homogeneous Poisson process, which relies on MTBF values. So I'm like, come on, let's get out of there.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out Iridicio's IBL Blended Learning for Maintenance and Reliability Professionals. This SMRP-accredited project-based curriculum will take you through all aspects of a maintenance and reliability program and provides you with all the tools you need to generate a 30 times return on investment for your organization and a set of credentials from the University of Tennessee for you. You can find out more at ibltraining.com.
So now that we understand the reliability growth analysis or CRO-AMSA model, what is a WIBLE and how does that vary from the CRO-AMSA? We talked about a couple of things, but...
Yep. So a WIBLE distribution is a generic, it's like Kleenex for tissues, right? It could be using a WIBLE distribution or a log normal distribution or a normal distribution or exponential distribution. There's literally hundreds of distributions available to describe think of it as a histogram. If you have 100 bearings out in your factory and you run them all till they fail, some will fail before other ones, right? Some will fail on Tuesday this week. Some will fail Thursday of next week. Some will fail next year. And if you put that time to failure, the dates essentially in a histogram, it'll describe some shape. It might be skewed to the left or it might be skewed to the right. It might be a normal looking shape. It might be bimodal. It may have different patterns to it. But it will describe some distribution. And I'm picking on bearings because Waddell Weibel, who came up with the Weibel distribution, studied bearings in bearing life. And he found that the Weibel distribution, which is actually a fairly simple mathematical construction, it describes the time to failure for bearings really, really well, very accurately. So if I can get enough failures, say 10% of my bearings have failed, and the rest of the bearings are being operated in a similar way. If I fit a line to that time to failure distribution using what we call a Weibel distribution or Weibel analysis, I can predict when the remaining 90% are going to fail. You know, how many are going to fail next month? How many are going to fail next year? It's really useful for stocking of spares and getting those numbers right. If I know that I have an increasing failure rate, which bearings do, I may need very few spares for the first year. But in the second year, I may need 4x the number of spares. And then the year after that, 8x the number of spares. But it follows a pretty consistent pattern assuming they're used in a similar fashion.
That's important. It's the same operating context, same types of conditions, and it's specific to its a wear out pattern or failure mode, if you will, right?
Right. It doesn't have to only be wear out. It could be early life failures also, but that's what makes it so versatile. It can describe time to failure distributions over a wide range of different behaviors. It's much more accurate. You know, for example, if I have one bearing that I use at 10 degrees C and three others I use at 80 degrees C and a dozen others that are used at 190 degrees C, the greases in those are going to wear and break down at very different rates simply because of the temperature. And so a lot of the physics of failure type modeling and of predictive maintenance type things need to take into account, well, what kind of load does it have? What kind of temperature does it have? What kind of usage pattern does it use? Whereas if I put bearings on a long conveyor belt, right, big roller belt, they're all seeing similar loads or seeing similar temperatures or seeing similar duty cycles. Those will behave along a single distribution very well. I may have to make adjustments for other situations where they're under different temperatures or loads or cycles. So it's the underlying premise of it is that you have the same failure mechanism, not just the same component and same area or same use, which helps, but it's that, is it the grease breaking down and metal to metal contact losing, I lose alignment, say, for, or it seizes on a bearing. Whereas another one gets hit by a forklift, that one's not as predictable, right? I can't tell you on bearing wear when a forklift is going to run into it.
Right. So,
that kind of thing.
With the Weibull then, if we have bearing failures related to alignment, we should have a Weibull analysis for that versus ones that have a mechanism of, you know, degradation of the lubricant, metal to metal contact, that sort of stuff. That should be a different analysis as well, right?
Yeah, and that's where I hedge because we almost never get to that
level of data.
That's right. Right. So if we just realize that it can be much more accurate, much more refined, the better your data is, the better your understanding of the failure mechanisms and the root cause of those failures. But if it's a repairable system and you're lumping in all causes into that, it still can describe it fairly well. Enough so that you can actually do reasonable spares and maintenance prediction cycles. So it's better than just guessing, but it's actually not bad in general. It's just when you move down into from multiple failure mechanisms to a single one, it becomes exceedingly or especially accurate.
Yeah, and we get very good predictions of wear out, time to wear out, those sorts of things. Whereas when we have that mixed, it's not nearly as, it's still good, but not as accurate.
Well, and to put it in context is instead of having to have, we might have had 10 spares in stock is kind of our trigger point. It was our nominal number of spares for this particular component. If I get a more accurate understanding of the failure mechanisms, I may be able to remove 2 spares. You know, but if you're buying them in 10 packs, then it doesn't really matter. The economic order quantity is going to be 10. So there's other factors that involve, but it's, you know, refining the failure analysis helps. It's not the do or die.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you mentioned that the Weibull is for non-repairable systems, meaning a bearing. You're not going to repair that bearing typically unless it's, you know, some of these specialized bearings I've seen in the past.
That's right.
It's if it's a small, you know, 1-inch ID bearing, you're probably just going to toss it, right? And that's when we want to use the Weibull.
Well, for all of these time to failure distributions, it's really the distribution is of individual items and units going from time zero, kind of out of the box, brand new things put into service, and then accumulating time, either calendar time or use time or cycles or whatever is appropriate for that item till it fails. Into its first failure. Now, there are distributions that deal with going to the second failure after its repair and so on. Recurrent data, it's called. And there's ways of doing that, but that's beyond what we've even talked about before and wrote about in the mean cumulative functions. So I'm going to leave that as for the serious student. You can go look at that. But if you're interested in time to first failure, when you know you got to go replace it, or what's the probability of this motor failing during our run over the next month, well, that's where a Weibull distribution comes in and can help you understand those probabilities of occurrence.
Now, one of the questions I got on Weibull was on sensor data. Mm-hmm. And to me, I want to make sure we're speaking the same language. So that is, we replace a bearing at a certain point, but it has not yet failed.
That's right.
That is sensor data, right?
That's right.
How does that fit into both models, reliability growth analysis or Weibull analysis?
I'd have to double check, but I believe in the reliability growth models, we're interested in accumulated time. So if I got a bearing that's or a system that's working, say we have 2 tanks in service and they're both running for the week, we get a couple hundred hours off of them, right, in use. If one of them doesn't fail, it still accumulates operating hours. And so that goes into the equation. And it counts towards our tally of hours between our failures, essentially, in the spacing out of those failures. So it's very informative in that regard. Whereas in the Weibull analysis, let's say we have 10 bearings that get started and one of them fails. That one failure is roughly, not exactly, but roughly the 10th percentile of that distribution. That's when we can expect the 10% of our future bearings to fail when they start from scratch, when they start from new. So it's the other nine just push that first failure to, instead of being an average or accumulated time divided, which we do for MTBF, it's saying, no, that failure happened at about the 10th percentile because there's nine more still running. So the ones that haven't failed are, think of them on that histogram, is they're going to fail out there someplace. We just don't know where yet. And so we subtract them from where we position that first failure on that curve.
Gotcha. Now, one of the other things that comes up with these models is how many data points do we need?
Thousands, thousands, thousands.
What is the bare minimum that we need to actually get something meaningful out of these? I'd love to have thousands of data points, but chances are we don't have that. So what is the bare minimum to make some of these models work?
20. 20 items, 5 failures for a Weibull analysis. CRO-AMSA, I'm not as sure what the actual working numbers are. It depends on your system. But I've seen them done with on the order of 20 failures in a couple of hundred hours.
Okay.
You know, so, the more is better, right?
Well, absolutely. You get the, you know, it becomes statistically significant. You start getting all that stuff. But for someone that wants to start looking at these tools, start figuring it out, if they have 20 data points, they can start to learn about it and play with it and start moving forward with it, right?
Yeah. And with a Weibull analysis, it's not 20 failures. It's 20 items that you're tracking.
With five failures.
With at least 5 failures. That's kind of the bare minimum. Yeah, 30 would be better. 30 failures, which we call complete data. If everything has failed, then you've got complete data for that subset, for that population. That's even better. Yeah. To get a very clear and accurate estimate of a slope for CRO-AMSA or for Weibull analysis, you do need hundreds and hundreds of failures and data points. In order to get an idea, is this an increasing slope or decreasing slope? 5 failures. As long as it's consistent failure mechanisms for a Weibull, then you're in pretty good shape.
And I know that's killing you to say 5 failures, 20 components, because it's not, you're a statistician. So it's not, doesn't give you that statistical significance and so on and so forth.
No, but you know, we're constrained by time. We don't have that many items. We may only have 20 of these things ever. And it might take us a week to track down all the times to failure for those 5 that have failed. You know, that's what we got. We got to deal with it. What you don't want is just one data point, you know, one failure, and then try to draw a line through that. Well, you can draw any line you want through one point. It's kind of fun. you look at your boss and go, what answer do you want? Let's draw that line. But as soon as you get a second point, right, now I can draw a perfect line. I can fit a slope in that and it's perfect. It's perfect fit. The line goes through both points. But there's no estimate of the variability of your data, right? From a statistician's point of view, there's no error term. So we don't know how variable our data is. And very likely the third point is going to dramatically change the slope, the information you're looking at. So when you get 5 and they fit along a relatively straight line on a regression analysis you're doing, which is what a Weibull analysis is, or it fits a CRO-AMSA model fairly well, it gives you a lot of confidence. Then if you're looking at a cloud of points and you're kind of randomly drawing a line through it, it's not statistical confidence or by any means, but it gives you a sense you're on track, that this is being consistent and it's can give you some information. I wouldn't do a $2 million project based on 5 points, but you're on the, you at least, you know, in an experiment, you're on the right track.
Perfect. And that's what we want, right? We don't have that perfect data. We don't live in that perfect world. So as long as we got a baseline to start, we can start to work with it.
That's right.
Now, any watch outs or cautions on either of these models that you want to share with our listeners?
The thing to do is don't dump your data into some statistics package, whether Minitab or ReliaSoft or Item Software or any of them that are out there. And you push a button and you get a number out. That number can be total fiction. It could be totally inappropriate. It could be absolutely misleading. It may have done the calculation perfectly right. It's one of those things I call a type 3 error, that you do the exactly perfect process for the wrong problem, for example. Plot it. As a minimum, plot your data. You know, put it on a Weibull plot, on a Weibull plotting paper. And does it look relatively straight? And if it doesn't, then ask why. Why is that curved? Why is that not fit a straight line? Why is that not behaving like it should after it gets over 3,000 hours? The base of most statistical analysis when done, that I've seen done well, and the way I've learned it, is it's an exploratory process. Is plot the data, let it tell you some stories, let it help you ask some better questions, explore it some more, understand, is this data representing two different complete different problems, or was there errors in the collecting of the data that you need to fix, or whatever. But histograms and probability plots and QQ plots and in similar ways to view the data often tell you a story that you just will never see if you run the calculation and says the beta is 2.2. Well, 2.2 doesn't mean anything if it's perfectly wrong. So look at your data, understand it. I wrote an article years ago, is let the data sing, right? Let it tell you the play the song that's within the data set itself. And the best way I know how to do that is to plot it. And then after that is make sure you understand what your software is doing. And to me, I'm old school this way, is do it by hand. You know, some things are greatly speeded up by using software, but just because Minitab or your calculator says the answer is 2.2 doesn't really mean it is, unless you can explain it and understand what assumptions it was making, how it was treating the data, how good the data quality was. And oftentimes a set of plots is a great way to tell if your data is telling you a true story all the way through.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think we actually did a podcast on that, is the importance of understanding, or maybe it was a conversation, but it was the importance of understanding the formula, the methodology, those sorts of things, and not just relying on software to push you through.
That's right.
Once you understand those assumptions, you can validate it using software. You can understand what assumptions were made to make see if it makes sense. But you need to understand what it is, why it's doing what it's doing up front before you can just throw these things into a tool and get a result.
That's right. You know, I've seen way too many times where somebody takes remain unnamed software package, but fill in the blank with whatever one you want. And they show the output screen and say, there's the answer. We should turn left here. And then somebody says, why is that the answer? How did we get there? And he can't explain it. And so it doesn't matter what the statistical confidence is that it's, if the people that need to make the decision don't understand what it means and how it got there, it's just a number on a screen. It doesn't really, not really helpful.
Absolutely. Now, aside from the ebook that we created in the series of posts we created mm-hmm. on these two devices, where can people find out more about this stuff? Is it Ascendo Reliability? What else?
Yeah, Ascendo Reliability's got a lot of that. ReliaSoft has a website called Weibull.com, which has tons of statistical stuff, including parametric and non-parametric and reliability growth and Weibull analysis, and every formula you'd ever want to know is all in there. the NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, I think is the name of it, is a U.S. government agency for standards and weights and measures and much more. But they have a engineering statistics handbook, or it might be statistical engineering handbook, one or the other. And it's got great examples and a bunch of code in it and explaining the topics we talked about today, but tons of other stuff like that. So those would be the sources I'd go to online. They're free. Lots of great info there. And then as much as most people cringe when they hear it, is your undergraduate statistics course, or go back to school and get a good statistics course. Those old books are really, really useful. They're still relevant.
Excellent. Those are some great resources. And I know we've talked in the past about statistics, fear of statistics, and how that drives some of the behaviors we see when working with this data. But I think it's important that people understand the underlying fundamentals of statistics and some other mathematical terminology.
Yep. Very true. Now, there's one other thing, James, another resource. I see it every now and then on EDX. It's the online university courses that are free. Is Berkeley, and I think Harvard has got one, and there's a few other universities that offer these massive open online courses, MOOCs, on statistics, base intro to statistics or statistical analysis and regression analysis and things like that. And they're done by some of the world's best teachers. So it's an investment. It takes some time to really get the most out of it, but the ones I've seen are absolutely excellent.
Perfect. I will have to dig those up and put those as links in the show notes as well. Well, Fred, before we go, I will first want to thank you for taking the time to talk about reliability growth analysis, viable analysis, and the differences between the two. But before we do that, where can people find out more about you? What activities or events are you involved with at the moment? All that fun stuff.
Well, we started the show with we're both in the throes of getting ready for the SMRP annual conference. So that's my most urgent stuff. Most of my other work and writing and efforts have been on the Ascendo Reliability site. And just did a podcast this morning on stress screening. It's more related to screening the products that you're making to make sure that they're useful and working as they should, don't have a particular defect in them. But we do monthly webinars. We've got courses on there. Next month is going to be our SVC and process capability month. So a bit more statistics and controlling processes and using that in designs and in improving our processes and yields, things like that. But yeah, Ascendo Reliability is pretty much where I'm hanging out these days.
Excellent. A great resource. You also got your podcast, Speaking of Reliability, which can be found at reliability.fm, which I'm not going to say frequent, but I'm on there occasionally to help talk about some topics and questions you have arise from time to time.
So. Yeah, no, I appreciate it. We just added another podcast to that called Reliability Rocks. I think he's up to episode 6 or 7. So for those binge listeners, you can quickly catch up with that show and stay up with his weekly program. But yeah, in the reliability.fm has been a lot of fun. I think we've got what, James? We got your show, Speaking of Reliability, Dare to Know, the recorded webinar episodes we do monthly, Reliability Rocks, Rooted in Reliability is yours, this one. So they know about that.
And the LCE one, I think, is on your site too, right?
Yes, that's right. LCE, the life cycle, is it engineers? Engineering, yes. Life cycle engineering. They have it up there. I haven't
Asset Reliability at Work.
Yeah. I haven't seen too many new episodes from them in the last couple of months. So I'm not really sure if they're taking a break or if they lost steam on that project. I'll have to check in with them.
Yeah. Not sure, but I appreciate it. And I appreciate all the work you do with giving us this platform, sharing your knowledge and all that great stuff. But thanks again for sharing your knowledge on these two great topics, and I will talk to you again shortly.
Great. Thanks, James.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the Reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.